Welcome to Ekhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI, and welcome to our deep dive. Today, we're getting into a really remarkable book, Michael Ondaatje's The English Patient.
Oh, a fantastic choice. It won the Booker and even the Golden Booker, right?
Exactly. And Ondaatje himself, he's Sri Lankan-born, moved to Canada, brings this incredible poetic sensibility to the novel form. It's not just plot. The language itself is part of the experience.
Absolutely. It's dense, lyrical. It feels different from a lot of contemporary fiction.
So our mission today, I think, is to try and unpack this complex structure. It's about war, love, memory. But really, it feels like it's digging into how identity itself works, especially when all the usual markers, like nationality, just fall apart.
That's a great way to put it. It explores how these fragmented memories, these broken pieces of people's lives, actually reveal deeper truths about who they are outside of those big imposed structures.
Okay, so let's set the scene. Where does Ondaatje drop us first? It's quite evocative, isn't it?
Oh, incredibly. We land in this bombed-out shell of a place, the Villa San Girolamo in Italy. It's right at the tail end of World War II. Chaos everywhere.
Yeah.
And this villa, it's almost ghostly. It becomes this unexpected sanctuary for four incredibly damaged individuals.
Right, the core four. You've got Hannah.
The Canadian nurse, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She's young, deeply traumatized by the war, almost hollowed out by loss.
And there's Caravaggio.
The thief-turned-spy. He's physically maimed, lost his thumbs during interrogation, and he arrives with this burning need for, well, initially it seems like revenge.
And Kip Singh, he stands out.
Kip, yeah.
Yeah.
The Sikh sapper from India, served the British Army. He's this expert in defusing bombs, incredibly focused and precise amidst all the emotional wreckage. It's a fascinating contrast.
And finally, the title character, the mystery man.
The English patient.
Yeah.
He's horrifically burned. Completely anonymous at first, kept alive by morphine and Hannah's care, his identity is the central puzzle.
So these four people thrown together in this room.
It immediately sets up the big question, doesn't it? Can you find real connection, real loyalty, maybe even love, when you're completely cut off from the world that defined you, your nation, your history, the war itself?
What happens when those labels just don't apply anymore?
Exactly. Who are you then?
And Ondaatje explores this using that signature structure, the non-linear narrative.
Yeah, it's brilliant, really. It jumps between the quiet, almost suspended present in the villa around 1945 and these intense, vivid flashbacks to the North African desert in the late 1930s.
It feels like memory, doesn't it? Messy, associative, not linear at all.
Precisely. And it's through the patient's memories, often morphine-induced, that we piece together who he is.
And the big reveal is he's not English.
Not at all. He's Count Laszlo de Almazi, Hungarian, a cartographer and explorer obsessed with the desert, a man who famously declared, "I hate nations," which becomes deeply ironic later.
His identity seems built less on where he's from and more on what he loved, right? Specifically, Catherine Clifton.
Catherine, yes. Mm-hmm. The heart of the tragedy in the past timeline. His all-consuming adulterous affair with her. She was married to another explorer, Geoffrey Clifton.
And the desert itself seems to mirror their relationship.
Totally. It's vast, beautiful, dangerous, and crucially borderless. It's a landscape outside the normal rules, just like their forbidden love.
Mm.
It's amoral in a way.
It's interesting, too, how he treats his copy of Herodotus's histories. It's not just a book for him.
No, it's almost like his real passport. He fills it with notes, drawings, scraps of his own life, personal memories mixed in with ancient history. It reinforces that idea that history for Almazi isn't grand narratives. It's intensely personal stories. Identity is curated, not assigned.
Okay, so let's follow that thread back to the desert. The affair leads to catastrophe.
Utter catastrophe. It's the climax of that past timeline. Catherine's husband, Geoffrey, figures out the affair. He's consumed by jealousy.
And he does something drastic.
He attempts a murder-suicide. He deliberately crashes his plane, carrying Catherine, intending to kill her, and Almazi, who's on the ground.
But it doesn't quite go as planned.
Geoffrey dies in the crash. Almost he survives. But Catherine, she's critically, horrifically injured.
And this leads to Almazi's desperate journey.
Yes. He carries her broken body across the desert for three agonizing days, searching for help. He finally finds shelter for her in the Cave of Swimmers, a real place, by the way, famous for its ancient rock paintings.
But he has to leave her there to get help.
He has to. He promises to return. He treks on alone and finally reaches a British outpost.
And this is the moment, the turning point, the betrayal, but not by him initially?
Exactly. It's the system that betrays him. Because of his foreign name, Laszlo de Almasy, and the wartime paranoia, they don't believe his story. They see a potential spy.
So instead of getting help,
they imprison him. Just like that. Bureaucracy, suspicion, the arbitrary lines on a map. They condemn Catherine.
That's such a powerful critique of nationalism, isn't it? The rules, the borders, the suspicion, they directly cause her death because he can't get back to her in time.
It's devastating. The human cost of these abstract political constructs. Almasy's grief and rage when he finally gets free. It consumes him.
And leads him to make his own terrible choices.
Completely. He feels utterly betrayed by their allies, by the concept of nations. So in his brokenness, he collaborates with the Germans.
But not for political reasons.
No, purely personal. He guides their spy across the desert, the same desert he once explored for knowledge and love, simply to get the means to return to the Cave of Swimmers, to Catherine.
His treason is an act of desperate, misplaced loyalty to her memory.
It's incredibly complex morally. When he finally gets back to the cave, she's dead, of course.
The scene where he finds her body?
It's heart-wrenching. He retrieves her body, puts it in the wreckage of an old plane he finds nearby, and tries to fly her out.
And the plane fails.
The engine catches fire, it crashes, and he's horribly burned. The Hungarian count becomes the nameless, faceless English patient we meet in the villa, erased by fire and grief.
It's such a brutal backstory, and it raises that question you hinted at, the moral ambiguity. Are we meant to excuse his collaboration with the enemy because it was driven by love and this profound sense of betrayal by the Allies?
I don't think Ondaatje asks us to excuse it, necessarily. But he forces us to understand it, to see how personal trauma and passion can completely overwhelm political allegiances. He refuses easy judgments.
He puts the map of the heart, as it were, on an equal footing with the maps of nations.
Right. Which brings us back to the villa, this supposed place of healing. After knowing Almasy's story, the quiet atmosphere there feels heavier, more significant.
It really does. It's presented as this hospital for the soul, right? A space to rebuild something human from the wreckage.
Yes, and we see arcs of attempted healing. Hanna, for instance, she arrives almost catatonic with grief over her father and perhaps a lost lover, too.
In the villa, she finds a way to offer care, unconditional compassion to the patient, even before knowing his story. And there's her tentative connection with Kip.
That relationship is so gentle, so fragile. It's like a flicker of warmth in the cold ruins. It represents her slowly, carefully trying to re-engage with life, with feeling.
And Kip himself, his role is fascinating. The sapper, the bomb disposal expert.
It's such a potent metaphor.
Yeah.
His job is literally to find and neutralize hidden dangers, hidden explosives left over from the war.
Just like everyone in the villa is trying to navigate their own hidden traumas, their emotional minefields.
Exactly. His meticulous work, his calmness under pressure, seems essential to the villa's fragile peace. But his position is also complex, an Indian Sikh, technically a colonial subject,
yeah,
serving the British Empire in a European war. He's an outsider in multiple ways.
And Caravaggio, he starts out wanting answers, maybe revenge, regarding the patient.
Yeah, he suspects the patient might be connected to his own capture and torture. He presses Almasy, trying to uncover his identity and past actions.
But something shifts in him.
It does. As he hears Almasy's story, this raw confession fueled by morphine, Caravaggio's anger seems to dissolve. It turns into a kind of weary understanding, maybe even empathy.
He becomes less of an interrogator and more of a confessor, a listener.
Almost like a reluctant father figure to Hanna, too. He sees her pain, Almasy's pain, his own pain, and realizes vengeance isn't the answer. Connection, shared experience, that's maybe the only way forward.
So the villa creates this bubble, this temporary community built on shared brokenness and tentative healing.
A very delicate bubble. And we know bubbles are meant to burst.
Right. The outside world, the war they tried to escape, inevitably intrudes. And it does so with devastating force.
This is the climax of the present timeline in the villa. And it's arguably the novel's most pointed political statement. It confronts Western power head on.
It comes via radio news, doesn't it?
Yes. News arrives of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And for Kip, this changes everything.
Instantly. Utterly. For Kip, who has dedicated his life, his incredible skill and precision to serving the British cause, to carefully disarming bombs, this news is shattering.
He sees it as, what? A betrayal.
A profound betrayal. He sees this act of dropping atomic bombs, this indiscriminate technological mass killing, as the ultimate hypocrisy of the Western powers he served.
He connects it to colonialism, to racism.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He feels it proves that, to the West, certain lives, specifically non-white lives in Asia, are considered expendable. It's the brutal logic of Empire laid bare. He looks at the patient, this European figure embodying a world of exploration and culture, but also now this barbarity.
And he feels implicated or disgusted?
Both, I think. Disgusted, okay. Betrayed. He sees the patient, maybe all of European civilization he'd served, as fundamentally flawed, capable of this horrific detached violence. His trust is completely broken.
And his reaction is dramatic. He turns on the patient.
It's terrifying. He takes his rifle, his sapper's knowledge of vulnerability, and confronts the patient. Seeing him as a symbol of this entire corrupt, destructive world, it's like all his suppressed tension, his outsider status, just explodes.
Does he kill him?
No, he doesn't pull the trigger.
Yeah.
But the connection, the fragile piece of the villa, is irrevocably destroyed.
He leaves.
He dismantles his camp methodically, packs his equipment, and walks away. He leaves the villa, leaves Hana, leaves that entire European context behind him forever. The war, which supposedly ended, reaches out and reclaims him, pulling him back towards his own history, his own identity, away from theirs.
Wow. So the healing was only ever provisional? The larger forces of history and politics couldn't be kept out?
Never. That seems to be Ondaatje's point.
So if we're distilling this for someone trying to grasp the core takeaways, what are the big messages here?
Well, first, I think, is that idea about identity. It's fluid, complex. Ondaatje suggests it's made up of, as he puts it, a richness of lovers and tribes, the tastes we've experienced, the people we've connected with, not just a name or a nationality stamped on a passport.
Identity as a personal collage, like Amos's Herodotus.
Exactly. And second, the inescapable moral ambiguity, especially in wartime. There are no easy heroes or villains here. Amos's betrayal of nations for love, Kip's ultimate rejection of the West. These are wrenching choices made under extreme pressure. The novel forces us to sit with that discomfort.
And the style itself is crucial for conveying this, right? The poetic language, the sensory details.
Oh, absolutely. It creates this dreamlike, almost hallucinatory quality at times. It allows him to explore these deep emotional states, this trauma, in a way straightforward prose might not capture. It mirrors the fragmented, subjective nature of their experiences.
So the lasting feeling is melancholic.
Deeply melancholic, I'd say. It shows the enduring cost of war, how the damage lingers long after the fighting stops, and that healing, if it happens at all, is always partial, always fragile. A provisional state, as you said.
What stays with me most, I think, is how it locates the most intense human dramas. Love, betrayal, loss, the search for meaning, not in the big historical events themselves, but in these small, broken, intimate spaces on the edges of the map.
Yeah. It's in the villa, in the cave, in the quiet moments between people where the real story unfolds.
Which leaves us maybe with a final question to ponder. Where should our deepest loyalties lie? To the abstractions of nations and flags, or to the real, messy, intense connections we forge the map of our own hearts?
That feels like the central challenge the book leaves us with.
Indeed. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.